welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our brand new Substack newsletter and website at letitrollpodcast.com. We've got archives of every episode, sorted by genre, era, guest, co-host, and mini-series. It's also a great way to support the show if you can afford it. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate hosts a second Let It Roll telepathic interview with the still living but unavailable Marianne Faithfull and her co-author David Dalton to discuss her autobiography, Faithfull. This episode gets into the adultery, betrayal, madness, arrests, public crucifixion, and aftermath that racked the Rolling Stones' inner circle in Brian Jones's final years. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today we're not joined by anyone because once again we're doing a telepathic episode. This is a continuation of the one we did last week about Marianne Faithfull's autobiography co-written with David Dalton called Faithfull, an autobiography. And I'm not sure exactly where I left off, but I know that I didn't talk about her fling with Keith Richards, which happened on the same night that she took LSD with Brian Jones, Keith Richards, and Tara, the Guinness heir, Tara Brown, I want to say. At the end of the night, both Brian and Tara had passed out, and Keith took Marianne to a hotel. And she said that it was the best night of lovemaking of her life, and that at the end of it, Keith said, Mick really loves you. You should give him a toss. And he's smitten, all right, Marianne. Is he really? Go on, love. Give him a jingle. He'll fall off his chair. He's not that bad when you get to know him, you know. And then she sums it up with said, I wish now I'd had the strength to say, fuck Mick, man. I like you. It's something I could sum it up now, but in those days it was totally beyond my range. Not that it would have helped. I was being given the brush off. And I knew Mick would be kind to me. Keith was a much more dangerous entity, really, much more mysterious. Maybe it was all for the best. Anita was still with Brian when I spent the night with Keith. Keith and I were on our own. But I knew in my heart of hearts that Keith was already in love with Anita. I could just feel that whatever he wanted, I wasn't it. I was too English and too conventional for him. So there's that little plot twist. This is such an incestuous tale between the five of them, Marianne Faithfull, Mick Jagger, Anita Pallenberg, Brian Jones, and Keith Richards. But shortly after that, Mick's courtship of Anita begins seriously. I think I've mentioned a little bit about that. They bonded over their knowledge of the Holy Grail myths and literature thereupon. And, Mick comes out of this. It's an odd thing because compared to Brian Jones, Mick certainly seems like a much better person. And even compared to Keith Richards, he's a much more conventional person. But he also comes across a little bit unsympathetic in that he's so normal and yet has some of his own personality flaws and twists. But the next big development is the infamous Redlands bust. And this was a morning when, or an evening when, the Stones group decided to have a party at Keith Richards' medieval mansion called Redlands out in the country. And George Harrison attended briefly that day. And as soon as he left, the police raided the party. And the whole group had been taking LSD. And we're enjoying what Mary Ann Faithfull describes as a wonderful feeling of warmth and security as the evening progressed. And then suddenly the police storm in and arrest everyone. And Marianne was had just taken a bath, and she had wrapped herself in a giant bearskin rug and was naked. And the police were very scandalized. And the News of the World tabloid, which is later shut down, I think, in 2011 for hacking the phones of the victims of the parents of the victims of child murders, they were just as awful in the 60s as they were in the 2000s. And they pretty much crucified Mary Ann Faithfull. And she describes the aftermath. But first, she describes how Keith became a legend. And here's what she had to say about this. Before the Redlands bust, Keith had been overshadowed by Mick and Brian both, but his defiance on the stand in court made him a major folk hero. This was the beginning of Keith's legend, a symbol of dissipation and the demonic. And the amazing thing is that subsequently he actually became that. Satan's right-hand man with the skull rings and demonic imagery, he turned it all to his advantage. And that was something that Marianne was not able to do, that she was not at all prepared for the tabloid level of publicity and scandal that was centered around her and the Stones. And for Mick and Keith, they both turned it to their advantage and you know, became much more well-known figures. After this bust, they were second only to the Beatles as far as cultural importance. But for Mary Ann Faithfull, she was pretty much destroyed publicly and privately. And she says, one of the casualties was my mother. It was after all the scandal that things began to fall apart for her. She started drinking heavily. She stopped showing up for work. She rarely went out of the house. She was ashamed about the Mars Bar gossip. And that's referring to this folk tale I think I mentioned last time, that when the police arrived, supposedly Mick Jagger was performing cunnilingus on Mary Ann Faithfull with a Mars Bar. I hope that Apple Podcasts can forgive me for discussing this 60-year-old ridiculous gossip, but that's the story. And anyway, the pretty much killed her mother and had a massive impact on herself. And she said, summed it up, that a curse is a very real thing. Like the Lady of Shalott, I got into a boat, painted my name on it, and drifted downstream. I've always been very suggestible. It's one of the reasons I have to keep so self-contained today. I don't live with anybody. I don't want people to influence me too much. But when I was young and impressionable, I must have believed those hate letters I got. And what they said about me came to be. Somehow the grotesque folk tale of the Mars Bar stuck to me, and it probably always will. I should have taken a cue from Mick. Mick spewed it out, recovered, and went on with his life. Forget what the cops think. If you want to cry, then cry, baby, cry, she said. And let's go ahead and hear our first song. And this is a song by the Rolling Stones called Shine a Light from their Exile on Main Street album. And it's widely believed to be the song that Mick Jagger wrote for Brian Jones. Shine a Light. And tellingly, Keith Richards didn't play on it at all. And that was the Rolling Stones' Shine a Light, Mick Jagger's tribute to Brian Jones, with Mick Taylor on guitar, Keith Richards nowhere to be found. Not a hypocrite, at least, Keith. You can give him that. And then the next big element in the story is the moment in Tangiers when Keith and Anita abscond together and abandon Brian Jones. The whole Stones camp abandoned Brian Jones in Morocco, which he richly deserved, but nonetheless, it was traumatic. Marianne tells the story of traveling to Morocco with Brian and Anita. And what she didn't know is that Anita and Keith had already begun an affair in the back of Keith's Bentley. The other threesome, Keith and Brian and Anita, had driven to Morocco in Keith's Bentley, and Brian had fallen ill and had to be hospitalized in France. And while Anita and Keith were alone in the car, they consummated their relationship, but didn't tell Brian at this point. And so Marianne then flew out. Anita flew back to England. She and Marianne flew out together, picked up Brian in France from the nursing home, and took him to Gibraltar. And he was dead set on going to the Rock of Gibraltar because he wanted to play tapes of the soundtrack he had made for a movie that Anita Pallenberg starred in, called A Degree of Murder. And Brian had done the soundtrack. It's pretty interesting soundtrack. It's not available anywhere except on bootleg DVDs of the movie. It was never released as a standalone recording, but you can find it on YouTube and hear it. He used Nicky Hopkins and Jimmy Page and all the session aces of London at the time. And it's kind of one of his last works, but he had this desire to play his music for the monkeys that live at the Rock of Gibraltar in Spain. And when he turned on the tape player, the monkeys were freaked out by his music, and Brian was inconsolable, crying and, you know, broken once again. The guy just couldn't win for losing. But Anita has an interesting insight Marianne, I keep calling her Anita, but she says, while Brian was frenziedly playing his music to the monkeys, Anita would say, "Don't you think Brian looks very pale and so dull and not very alive? He's very bloodless, wouldn't you say?" And I looked at him and had to agree. "Well, yes, he does look a bit peaky. He didn't look too well, but I liked the way he looked. He had that romantic pallor of the very ill." I couldn't even hold up my end of the conversation, much less help Brian. But I remember looking at Anita, and it seemed I had never seen anyone so gleaming and alive and vibrating. She was dazzling. And next to her was the fading, pathetic Brian Jones, looking very sickly indeed. He barely made it through another year after that, maybe a little longer. He wasn't quite on his last legs yet. He was still trying to hold it together, trying to hang on to the woman he adored. And then she describes how Brian and Anita got in a fight, and Brian broke his arm trying to hit Anita and instead hit the iron frame of a window. And actually, this is not the trip where they dumped Keith and Anita. This is a previous trip that Brian and Anita managed to maintain their relationship through this one. But then soon after, they go back to Morocco and they're dumped. And it was in Morocco that Anita sloped off with Keith. Keith is a very straight arrow. He was appalled that Brian had beaten her up. And of course, Keith had been in love with Anita for ages, never saying anything to anybody. I don't think he ever thought he'd get Anita. And he wouldn't have if Brian hadn't acted like such an asshole. After the scenes in Morocco, Keith came along like the proverbial knight on the white charger and carried her off in his Bentley. He'd just gotten that Bentley and he'd taken it all the way to Morocco. He'd had it driven there, that crazy thing with men in their cars. And then she has an interesting note about Mick in this context when Keith has stolen Anita. Marianne describes, "Mick was wonderful at this time, really surpassed himself, loyal, true, proper, and just great in every way. Brian, Keith, and Anita were all behaving abominably, but Mick was cool and honorable throughout the whole business, always trying to do the best thing, taking the high moral ground. He didn't get involved in petty games, but because of his love for Keith, he was unable in the end to sustain this objectivity. When you love somebody, you can't help but take sides. And with Anita and me already very close, Brian soon found himself shut out altogether." Then there's a very interesting story that's very atypical of Mick. And she describes being in Italy, in Genoa, when the Stones played a show. And it was very nip and tuck whether or not the Stones would even be able to do that tour, because Brian was so upset that Anita had left him, and also that the entire Stones organization had abandoned him in Tangiers, literally with no money, nothing. They sent him out on a fool's errand to downtown Tangiers, and when he came back to the hotel, it was all empty and he'd been abandoned. with no money, no credit cards, nothing, managed to get his way home. And the only way that he agreed to do this European tour they had booked was Anita promised she would come back to him. And briefly, they did reignite their relationship, but then he beat her up one more time, and that was the last straw. But Marianne has her own horrifying story, and the Stones played this gig in Genoa, Italy, and she describes it when Mick came back to the hotel room. She says, evidently there had again been riots at the show that night. People had been trampled. Mick came straight from the concert to the hotel. I was waiting for him in the bed in my negligee. The minute he walked in, he was a different person. It was as if he were someone I didn't know. He was absolutely possessed, as if he had brought in with him whatever disruptive energy went on at that concert. It goes both ways, from the performer to the audience, and then it comes back at you magnified. He didn't say hello. He didn't even acknowledge me. He just walked over to the bed and began slapping me across the face. Not a word was spoken. I was absolutely terrified, and I fled into the big white bathroom. He followed me in there and continued to hit me. He beat me quite badly, and I didn't have a clue why. My first thought was, oh, shit, he must have found out that I had a little night with Keith. Such a ridiculous thought. In any case, I knew Keith would never in a thousand years have told anyone. Even Anita didn't know. Nothing brought it on. It just erupted out of some inner turmoil, as if a demonic force had taken him over. When it was over, it was like a hurricane that had spent itself and stopped. We never, ever mentioned it. To this day, I don't know what it was about. He never did anything like that again. He's not the kind of person who would. I don't think it was anything to do with me or him. He didn't know what he was doing, a victim of mob lunacy. So that is something right there. I think that would get Mick canceled these days, but it's a pretty minor tale in this and Marianne's account. And then she's got some more interesting insights about her life with Mick. She says, living with Mick, I learned early on to disregard myself as a sexual entity. He was the sex object to everybody. It's much easier to appreciate someone's erotic fascination, their homosexual appeal, when you're a long way away from it, believe me. To feel all that charge and to know it mustn't come to you is a funny feeling for a woman. So that was that was that. And then she's got some insight about Mick and Keith and the aftermath of the trial and acquittal after the Redlands incident, the Redlands bust. Both of them were found guilty, and Keith in particular was looking at a full year sentence for the crime of having allowed his house to be used to smoke hashish. And Mick was looking at a shorter sentence because he had some pills in a pocket of a jacket. They're actually Marianne's pills, but Mick gallantly took the blame and was looking at some months in prison for that. But the backlash was so big that the British authorities threw the cases out and I believe acquitted them afterwards. But Marianne has a note that says, the trial and acquittal bonded Mick and Keith, but it created a very odd dynamic. For Keith, it was just an alliance within a group, but for Mick, it was a lot more than that. It had all the irrationality and passion of a love affair. It's a pity that the things put Mick down for are what make him Mick, his narcissism and his queeniness. Lennon and McCartney had a similar bond between them, not as strong, of course, but both groups had these duennas, these strange bisexual, almost witchy figures as managers, Brian Epstein and Andrew Oldham. And she talks about going to see the Maharishi, et cetera, et cetera. And has one last note I thought was interesting about Mick's use of LSD. She says, I think all that acid in the 60s did Mick a world of good. He transcended all his pettiness, his guardedness. Mick became much more open and bloomed, and everything went brilliantly for him. Now when I read interviews with Mick, he says he regrets it all terribly. He says during this time he wasn't really himself. And of course, something did take us over. Mick allowed himself to be a channel. And in the end, that bothered him. LSD burned away all the dross. Ultimately, he completely rejected it. Let's see, what's the next piece? So I guess it's time to listen to our next song. And this is from Marianne's Broken English album. This is the title track of it from 1979. This was her big comeback album after years in the wilderness, living literally penniless and homeless as a street junkie for at least a couple years, completely on her own. But this is the song Broken English, the title track of her 1979 album. And that was Marianne Faithfull's performance in Broken English from her comeback album in 1979, which is, I think, a little dated, the backing music of it, very much of its era, but it's an era that's aged well. But the next big element of the story of this fivesome that I'm focused on, and apologies to Marianne Faithfull and her fans, I'm really less interested in her story per se than I am her relationship with Mick and Keith and Brian Jones and Anita Pallenberg, just because I've been obsessed with this particular dynamic my entire since I was 15 years old, and she's helped me understand it. But one of the things that happened next is that Mick and Anita started a movie called Performance, directed by a guy named Donald Cammell, and another actor named James Fox played it. And it's the story of a rock star, a reclusive rock star, and a gangster who breaks into his house. And there's some role reversal wherein the gangster, played by James Fox, who in real life was actually an upper crust actor, is shocked by the decadence of the rock star as played by Mick Jagger. And she talks about how Mick based his role of Turner as a combination of Brian Jones and Keith Richards. She says, "My reading of Turner was as a symbolic figure, vaguely tragic, a little pathetic, but still with an edge. He was the archetypal 60s rock apocalypse character, a pre-Raphaelite Hamlet. We worked it out very carefully and put it together element by element. I suggested he start forming his character based on Brian. Also, his hair should be a very strong, definite color. To do Turner as a blonde would have been too much. In the end, he dyed it black, very black, a Chinese black like Elvis's hair. The idea of using Brian as the basis for Turner was a good start, but as soon as you begin rehearsing the script, it was obvious this was too simplistic. Characters on the stage, and especially in movies, are composites, like dream characters. So we thought, what about Brian and Keith? Brian with his self-torment and paranoia, and Keith with his strength and cool. Mick's personality was not dark enough or damaged enough to support a mythic character such as Turner. Turner was a sort of jaded Prince of Denmark Street, but Mick was no Prince Hamlet. There's nothing truly mythic or tragic about Mick. He's too normal, too sane, for any truly bizarre fate to befall him. Brian and Keith seemed, if not actually tragic figures, at least fated personalities, human beings with fatal flaws caught in the tow of deep undercurrents. All underneath all these overlays, a lot of Mick bled through, so in the end you had a wonderfully complex characterization. He did his job very well. So well, in fact, he became this hybrid character. What I hadn't anticipated was that Mick, by playing Brian combined with Keith, would be two people who are extremely attracted to Anita, and who are in turn obsessed with her." And then she gets into Donald Cammell, the director, and says, "Let's face it, we were all pretty lightweight, pretty naive compared to Donald Cammell. Donald was older and much more devilish. This is why Andy was afraid for James's immortal soul. Andy was James Fox's wife. She was very chary of Anita, too. Anita was the dark queen under an evil spell, so gorgeous and dangerous. But the sarcastic, sophisticated, and decadent Donald was the major Dracula. Donald's method of directing was to set up a vortex. Into this vortex went into every disorienting thing you could imagine. God knows what drugs were being taken on the set. And then add to all that the indiscriminate sex. James Fox was, of course, very fearful about sex and drugs and rock and roll, but he was even more terrified of his own dark side. From a very proper and respectable British theatrical family, he was suddenly plunged into a den of iniquity filled with drug-snorting, hedonistic rock and rollers, and decadent, sexually ambivalent aristocrats. His sole bearings depended on Mick, someone with whom he already had a problem gauging the genuine from the put-on. He was totally out of his depth. Performance exposed a lot of things and exposed a lot of people to things that they had wisely stayed clear of. While Performance was being filmed, I felt quite erroneously that I had nothing to worry about. I never imagined Mick would be fucking Anita. I see Anita as very much a victim of all this, the vulnerable one who should have been looked after and protected. Her breakup with Brian over the previous year had been devastating. It was only natural she would find Mick's incarnation of Turner irresistible. Their characters were propelled toward each other, and she already had a hard time distinguishing what was real and what was imaginary. The only person who was never out of control and might have showed some restraint was Mick. But poor Mick was on a bit of a high wire himself. He was somewhat cowed by Donald Cammell, who had a ferocious temper and would go off like a firecracker, unleashing blistering tirades. Mick found the whole process of filming very bewildering. I tried not to think at all. I concentrated on living with my mother and Nicholas in Ireland and pretending everything was okay. Even the customarily fearless Keith couldn't handle this one. While filming was going on, Keith deliberately stayed away from the set. To go up there would have meant a head-on clash with Mick. Keith knew that if he had ever done so, it would have been the end of the band. And so, yeah, I mean, this is crazy stuff, that the incestuousness and double-crossing. And this is kind of at the point, I guess, when Mick checkmated Keith, when he took Anita away from Keith, even if it was only temporary. Keith and Anita went on to get married and have children together. And Keith wrote Gimme Shelter about this period of his life. He was spending a big part of the time in his limo outside the film set, bleeding to death emotionally while his woman and his best friend were having an affair. And Marianne sums it up, says, certainly Mick came out of it splendidly with a new, shining, and impenetrable suit of body armor. He didn't have a drug problem and he didn't have a nervous breakdown. Nothing really touched him. In the same way that some actors get to keep their wardrobe, Mick came away from performance with his character. This persona was so perfectly tailored to his needs, he'd never have to take it off again. This is Mick Jagger, as far as most of the world is concerned, and by this point, probably to himself as well. He came out of performance with two new characters, actually. The one we know and feel whatever it is we feel about it, that Mick, and another more sinister one, the gangster figure, heart of stone type. This character first appears when Mick sweeps his hair back and becomes the ruthless thug who will do anything, including killing people for money. The money-mad Mick, devotee of Mammon. Heavy duty stuff. It's time to take a sponsor break, and when we come back, we'll pick up more of the wreckage with Marianne Faithfull and the Rolling Stones.
Hey, Pantheon listeners. Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
And there's a whole chapter in the book called My Frankenstein, and this is where Marianne you know, she's like, if I'm going to be trapped with these Lord Byron type characters, where's my masterpiece, comparing herself to Mary Shelley, who came out of that experience of being married to Percy Bysshe Shelley, the great poet, and knowing Lord Byron, the other great poet, so well, and of course wrote the book Frankenstein as a result of a ghost story contest that she'd had with the two and another friend. And so Sister Morphine, which we played last time, becomes Marianne's masterpiece. But what I didn't remember last time was that Decca, her record company, pulled the record off the market after only 2 days in release. And then 2 years later, it's re-recorded by the Stones, taking her credit off, which she had to sue to get the credit put back, which, since she had recorded and released it with her own name on the songwriting credit, she had a pretty good basis for. But then she talks about Mick and Keith and the end of Brian and kicking Brian out of the band. That she says, as 1969 plunged on, I was becoming increasingly worried about Brian. I could feel something very nasty coming. So I suggested to Mick that we throw the I Ching about Brian and see what we should do. It was just dusk when I threw the coins. The reading I got was death by water. I turned to Mick and said, that's odd, isn't it? And he said, my God, do it again. I did it again and got the same thing. We just looked at each other. Finally, I said, look, this isn't good at all. We've got to do something. And he said, we have to phone, see if he's all right. And he actually did. Must have been guilt. Brian was at Redlands, that's Keith Richards' mansion, with Tom Keelock. Tom Keelock was a semi-sinister minder, and bodyguard and driver that the Stones had. And she says, Brian must have been astounded to get a call from Mick, the cynical, mocking Mick whom he hated. But there was another side to Mick, and that was the Mick who was on the phone to Brian saying, hey, how have you been, man? Brian was just delighted. He was always pathetically grateful for any tiny crumb of kindness, and he responded effusively. He opened like a flower. Oh, Mick, how lovely. Please come down and have dinner with us. So that's what we did. We got into the Bentley and off we went. Our intentions were fine. We got down to Redlands and there was Brian with Suki Poitier. She was very beautiful, but perfectly silly. And the thing to know about Suki Poitier was she was the woman in the car with Tara Brown when he blew his mind out in the car to get immortalized in the Beatles song Day in the Life. She was literally in the car with him when he killed himself in the car wreck. And you know, it's pretty ghoulish that Brian and Suki ended up partnering after Anita left Brian for Keith, and Suki was dealing with the grief of losing Tara Brown. But she was no Anita Pallenberg. Anyway, they arrive at Redlands, and Suki was very suspicious, and our sudden concern did look a little like Greeks bearing gifts. I think we were bearing gifts, actually. They'd cooked us dinner, but Mick is fussy about his food and drink. Everything has to be perfect. He's a Leo and a star. So we walked in, and without warning, Mick had one of those terrible mood changes that he had on occasion, so he turned to me and said, I can't eat this shit. We'll have to go out. So after coming down on a friendly visit in care and concern, we ended up mortally offending Brian. I wish I could say I hadn't, but I did the only thing I knew then, which was to acquiesce. I could have said, why don't we all go out? But there were so many other things going at once, so many factors to consider. I think Brian was probably too ill to go out or too paranoid. He was very frazzled. Perhaps that was why they'd cooked dinner there in the first place. But they go out to eat and then come back, and then Mick and Brian end up in a fist fight about everything, I suppose. Nothing was said. They were just flailing about, hitting each other. I think in a way that must have been Mick's chosen form, the physical, since he was such an athlete. It was sort of a courtly thing to do, like jousting. Except here it was a rather ungainly punching and shoving match. What a joke. There was Mick in perfect physical condition, and Brian, who could usually barely move. But swelled by rage, he became quite agile, until in the midst of battle, Brian fell into the moat. That ended it. I thought, death by water must be a symbolic message. What a relief. The angle that she doesn't put in this story, that someone else, and I can't remember who, which biographer has the rest of the story in it, but apparently Brian jumped into the moat and pretended he was drowning, and Mick ran in to save him. And as soon as Mick gets into this filthy, muddy moat, Brian stands up to his full height and he's only, you know, knee deep in the water. And Mick was even more furious that he'd been tricked into trying to rescue Brian Jones. And then a little bit more about Brian. She says, Brian died in a drunken muddle with no one trying very hard to look after him. A puffy, bewildered, raging, depressed muddle. When the phone rang at 4 a.m, it was always Brian, a thin, faint voice with labored breathing like a ghost who'd looked up your number in a call box, someone fading away before your very eyes. One of the things that keeps you alive when you're on the skids is that people care what happens to you. It's your lifeline, and with Brian, nobody really cared anymore. He would test levels of endurance, and no one had any patience left. He did it all the time, endlessly. For Brian, relations with other people always took place in the extreme. The only kind of affection or friendship he could tolerate was unconditional love. For men, women, girlfriends, chauffeurs, waiters, groupies, hangers-on, even with that, he could only just about cope with life. Anything less, he found about tricky. They find out Brian dies. The Stones have a concert on July 5th, just a couple days, I think literally 2 days after Brian died. And then Mick and Marianne fly to Australia, where they're going to star in Ned Kelly. And I'm going to play another song. When I come back, I'll tell you what happened in Australia. And this is the Ballad of Lucy Jordan, from the Broken English album. This was written by the great Shel Silverstein, the country songwriter. And that was Marianne Faithfull doing the Ballad of Lucy Jordan. And then so she tells a tale of arriving in Sydney. And she says, by the time we got back to the hotel in Sydney, I'd forgotten not only where I was, but who I was. I looked in the mirror. What I saw was a very thin, frightened face. I'd cut my hair. I was anorexic, and my skin looked cadaverous. I saw someone literally falling apart, someone with blonde hair looking very scared. In my drug-induced stupor, she'd been dropping Tylenols, the barbiturates, all the way on the flight. I dimly recognized the ravaged face of Brian Jones staring back at me. I was Brian, and I was dead. And so then she goes on and takes all the pills, deliberately overdosed. And she says, Mick was asleep. I walked around the room. I looked out the window. Our hotel room was on the 45th floor, and it looked out over Sydney Harbor. I attempted to open a window, but the windows didn't open. Had I been able to open the window, I would have jumped. The Tylenols were taking forever to kick in. I looked down and saw things on the street that shouldn't have been there. I recognized a number of people and waved to them, and then I saw Brian Jones. At that moment, I went into a coma that lasted 6 days. When I first spotted Brian, he was far below at street level, but greatly enlarged, a blow-up of himself. Various parts of him, his face, his hands, expanded and extended toward me as he spoke, and then he rose straight up as if on a shaft of air until he was directly opposite the window of our room. He was boxy with a wan face, dressed in King's Road medieval and lace and fur with red and yellow striped pants. His hair was green, and Buddhist lightning bolts were tattooed on his palms. As he raised the palms of his hands to me, he smiled that pan smirk of his. There was no weather, no wind or rain or sunshine or darkness. There was nothing recognizable at all. The grandeur and enormity of the place had the phantasmagoric mood of illustrations by Edmond Dulac or Durer's engravings of hell. As we were walking along, I realized that Brian had no more idea of where we were going than I did. Obviously, he had woken up dead, not known where he was, and decided to call for me. It was the nicest chat I ever had with him, actually. He told me how he had woken up and put out his hand for his bottle of Valium and about the panic that had seized him when he found nothing there. He said he had been lonely and confused and had brought me to him because he needed to talk to somebody he knew. We strolled blithely along as the quivering earth crumbled away on either side of us, and he told me about his miniature coronation set with the Beefeaters and coach and horses. He said he liked books about railway bridges, guides to switching boxes, George MacDonald's fairy tales, and Fox's Books of Martyrs. I said I'd get them for him when I got back to London. Afterward, he became very weepy like the Mock Turtle in Alice in Wonderland and said he was very sorry to put me to all this trouble. He didn't seem to know he was dead. Brian, dear, isn't this lovely, I said, trying as usual to distract him from grisly realities, but my sudden descent to small talk must have tipped him off that something was wrong. I was speaking to him in the patronizing way people talk to mad people, children, and small dogs. Nevertheless, he plunged ahead in typical Brian fashion. Death is the next great adventure, he said portentously. Oh, yes, I quite agree, I said fervently, as if we were speaking of a new religion or a new drug. His mood changed abruptly. Was it beginning to dawn on him where he was? Had I perhaps transferred the thought telepathically to him? He turned and put his hands on my shoulders. Welcome to death, he said brightly. I wasn't quite ready to be that enthusiastic about our situation. Tried to treat it like a joke. Oh, is that where we are? I asked. Well, you won't find any hotels here, darling, or any restaurants either. You won't need them. We came to the edge of the landscape. It dropped off abruptly and completely. There was a very obvious point where he chose whether to go over the edge or not. Brian said, coming, and slipped off the cliff. I drew back. I heard a chorus of voices calling to me, but I wasn't ready just yet. And then she describes opening her eyes 6 days later. And tells a tale of how nobody really wanted to hear that story, that everybody she told that story just acted like she was a lunatic and wanted no part of hearing it. And then she wraps up what the impact of Brian's death was on the group. She says, Brian's death acted like a slow motion bomb. It had a devastating effect on all of us. The dead go away, but the survivors are damned. Anita went through hell from survivor's guilt and guilt, plain and simple. She developed grisly compulsions. One of them was that terrible business of cutting out pictures of Brian and sticking them up on the wall, and in the morning tearing them all down. It was a recapitulation of what Brian used to do with his tapes. It's a psychotic thing people do when they've gone over the edge. They create something and destroy it. Keith's way of reacting to Brian's death was to become Brian. He became the very image of the falling down stone junkie perpetually hovering on the edge of death. But Keith, being Keith, was made of different stuff. However much he mimicked Brian's self-destruction, he never actually disintegrated. And so, yeah, that's it. She says, in families, there's always one person, almost always a woman, who is designated to be the mad one. In my circle, I was the one elected. And since we lived our lives in the pages of the tabloid press, I became famous for it. So, and then one last little nugget she has is, as she describes, she says, Brian was so far ahead of Mick and Keith. When Mick and Keith were up on stage trying to learn how to be sex objects, Brian already had illegitimate children. Brian was acting on it faster than anybody else. He knew his stuff very well. In the beginning, Mick and Keith were still schoolboys. Brian was the one who did the hustling, getting people together and believing it, knowing it, unlike Mick, who couldn't make up his mind whether he wanted to become an accountant. Brian was the one saying, look, it's going to happen. We're going to make it. At the same time, he had it in his hand. He could control it. And so he did control it. And when they found out he was right, that they were going to make it, and they did make it, instead of appreciating what he did, they resented it. And that's when Brian's doom really started. They had a vendetta, Mick and Keith, a real vendetta. We all saw Brian's death coming. There wasn't a great deal of remorse about it. And in any case, it just wasn't in Mick's nature or Keith's either to dwell too long on this sort of thing. Brian's dying was something of a relief. It solved a terrible predicament for them. After Brian's death, I thought we were all in trouble. I didn't know that it was I who was in trouble. And that's the story of Marianne Faithfull and the Rolling Stones. So a little bit of a warning tale. And let's hear our last song. This is her version of John Lennon's Working Class Hero, again from the Broken English album. And that was Marianne Faithfull's version of Working Class Hero, the John Lennon 1970 classic, redone in 1979 for her Broken English album. And I'd say she claims a song. So, final thoughts on all this. At first, just grateful to Marianne Faithfull for having the courage to tell her story and tell it so honestly. As far as we can tell, it's honest. Just a devastating thing to get that close to fame. And the Stones were more than just famous. They were cultural symbols of their era and symbols of the change that was happening in that era. And this was a time when, it was the Beatles or Stones. The Beatles were the good guys for the good kids, and the Stones were the bad guys for the bad kids. And they certainly lived it. And, you know, Lennon and McCartney and Harrison and Starr, they were tough kids from a tough part of Liverpool. They're actually, you know, Lennon was a little bit more middle class than the rest, but they were actual working class heroes, whereas the Stones were much more middle class, with the exception of Bill Wyman. But Brian Jones in particular was quite privileged. His dad was an engineer, and Mick Jagger's dad was a PE teacher at a very nice school. Keith Richards was a little bit more working class with divorced parents. But the Stones were very much middle class wannabes who, I guess, since they had to put on the act, worked harder at living it. And Brian Jones, you know, he wasn't acting, I guess. He was living it in a way that impacted Mick and Keith. And I certainly can't blame anyone but him for the damage that he wrought and the scars that he put on Mick and Keith and Anita and Marianne and everyone else he came into contact with. I don't know why I'm fascinated with the guy. I have been ever since I got the Rolling Stones High Tide and Green Grass album when I was a kid. And there's this fascinating figure standing on the cover, and I didn't know who he was and didn't know what he had done, and spent the rest of my life trying to figure it out since then. There's one last thing about Mick that I want to say. Let's see, that Marianne says. Let's see. By this time, I don't think he knew any longer where his image ended and the real Mick Jagger began. I wasn't quite sure either. Much of the turmoil for me had to do with Mick's inability to separate himself from his image, his compulsion to see life in a perpetual Sunday supplement where you watch yourself leading your life, but you don't feel anything. It's spooky. But what I didn't know then and can see very clearly now was this was always the arrangement. The pretty girl, the beautiful house, the well-turned-out children, and da-da-da-da-da make everything look right. Everything has to look right from the outside. It's a much harder deal than it seems. I mean, it must be hard if Bianca couldn't take it anymore because she'd been bred for this. His damn image pervaded everything. I can see now that even the way he dealt with the bust at Redlands was an extension of his obsession with his image. The theater of it took over almost immediately. It was priceless stuff. He could be noble and suffer and be martyred and have marvelous photos taken of him handcuffed in his ruffled velvet suits, like bloody Charles I on the way to his execution. He got the full exposure out of it that he always likes to get. And so that's the last word on Mick Jagger and Marianne Faithfull. So thanks for listening. Next time we'll be back. I'm going to be talking about the first of two autobiographies of Stones manager Andrew Lou Oldham, who's yet another incredible character in this tale. And he tells his tale very well. So for Let It Roll, I'm your host, Nate Wilcox. And today's book has been Faithfull, an autobiography by Marianne Faithfull and David Dalton. Thanks for listening.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Monday, Nate continues the Let It Roll Nightmare series with a recast of his 2022 interview with Joel Selvin that breaks down the exact mechanics of the Rolling Stones disaster at Altamont. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.